Hello, my name is Dan Kalinski. I'm a QC at Landmark Chambers, specialising in non-domestic rates. This is a short podcast, the focus of which is the approach of the non-domestic rates system to home working. That is to a degree topical because I think almost everybody is currently working from home, dealing with my work through a series of Skype business, Zoom and telephone calls from my home office. So this reminds me of the leading case in this area, a case called Tully and Jurgensen from 2003. It happens to be one of my first cases in the Lands Tribunal, and so it's a case which I have some fairly fond memories of. But I think it's a useful case to reflect upon because it sets out an approach which I think has some implications and importance in other areas. Now, I'll start with a spoiler alert. There's no sensationalism here. The approach that is adopted is an eminently sensible one, and one that leads to there being no problem in terms of potential non-domestic rates liability in every conceivable case, really, of somebody working within their house without a degree of adaptation of that house, creating discrete areas. But that was a result of the President of the Lands Tribunal rejecting the submissions that were advanced in the facts of Tully. So I think it's useful just to have a look at Tully to see what the issue was in that case and to see how that issue was resolved by the President of the Lands Tribunal. So that's what I'm going to do, and then reflect on what lessons there are that can be derived from that. So the facts of Tully are pretty easy to get one's head around. Mrs. Tully was, as it happens, an employee of the Inland Revenue. She'd suffered an injury and as a result of back problems was unable to commute to her place of work, and therefore, pursuant to the Inland Revenue's obligations under the disability discrimination legislation, they had made reasonable adjustments to enable her to work from home. And what they had done is that they had provided her with a fair amount of equipment, a desk, an ergonomic chair, a computer, a printer, a fax machine — obviously that dates the case — a notice board, which was used for Inland Revenue internal memos and matters such as that, and some lockable filing cabinets where work information was kept. And Mrs. Tully had effectively kitted out a spare room in her house as her work office. It wasn't exclusively used for home office. There was also an airing cupboard in there, and the facts record the fact that an ironing board and a vacuum cleaner and some Christmas decorations were stored there, and also that other uses took place in that bedroom, such as ironing. There was a fold-out bed there, and other members of the house were able to work there, but only on the condition that the revenue computer was logged off and all of the work equipment relating to Inland Revenue work had been put away before any such use took place. So if we take just a moment to orientate ourselves in the statutory scheme relating to non-domestic rates, section 42 of the 1988 Act provides that non-domestic hereditaments must be included in the local rating list, and section 64(8) provides that a hereditament is non-domestic if it consists entirely of property which is non-domestic, or if it is a composite hereditament. And 68 subsection 9 states that a hereditament is composite if part only of it consists of domestic property. Now, domestic property is defined in section 66 of the 1988 Act, and that is property which is used wholly for the purposes of living accommodation. So the issue in Tully was whether the room with this equipment provided by the Inland Revenue was part of a house which is used wholly for the purpose of living accommodation within section 66, or whether the use that Mrs. Tully makes of that first floor rear bedroom takes it outside of that provision. The valuation officer had concluded that the house could not be said to be used wholly for the purpose of living accommodation because of the scale and intensity of the work use which was taking place in this bedroom, and the fact that there was a degree of equipment that had been provided by the employee, and this was the place where Mrs. Tully was effectively working full time as an employee. Was some case law which was discussed from some pre-existing cases, two of which were referred to in the decision, one of which was a case called Fotheringham and Wood, which concerned an accountancy business which had been set up in a home, but that was slightly different because there were a couple of employees who were based there and there was a degree of adaptation of the property. And there was also a case called Bell and Rycroft, which concerned a nursery business which was at home, but again there had been a degree of adaptation to the premises. In both of those instances there had been the creation of a composite hereditament and a non-domestic rates liability had attached, and the revenue were relying on those cases to say that a similar approach should be taken in the case of Mrs. Tully's house. The president of the Lands Tribunal, Mr. Bartlett, rejected those submissions, and his key to unlocking the puzzle was to take a broad and purposive approach to the concept of use for the purpose of living accommodation. And so the critical part of the judgment is paragraph 17, where he built upon a concession that had been made in the course of argument by the valuation officer that a person working at home could be using his or her house for the purpose of living accommodation. And Mr. Bartlett said as follows, residential property in which an occupier works avoids being rated not simply where the use for the purposes of work can be regarded as de minimis, but also where such use is properly to be viewed as use for the purposes of living accommodation. The purposes of living accommodation are plainly not confined to the satisfaction of basic bodily needs of the persons residing in the property. Recreation and leisure facilities, for instance, are provided as part of the living accommodation. If there is a separate room for such purposes, a television room or a billiard room, for instance, the house does not cease on that account to be used wholly for the purposes of living accommodation. The position may well be the same, it seems to me, where a person works at home. Many people do work at home, both the self-employed and the employed. Professional writers, for example, have always usually done much of their writing at home. The word processor and the internet and email have enabled increasing numbers of people to work at home, where previously they would have had to go to an office every day. Where a person working at home uses accommodation, furniture and equipment of the kinds that are commonly to be found in domestic property, such use will in general, in my judgment, constitute use for the purposes of living accommodation. Rateability may, however, arise if the accommodation is adapted so as to lose its domestic character, or where the equipment of a non-domestic sort is used to a significant extent. Similarly, if employees or clients come to the premises, this may constitute a use going outside the ambit of the use for the purpose of living accommodation. The question always will be one of fact and degree. So the essence of the reasoning is to create a broad purposive approach to what the purposes of living accommodation can be, and to seek to find a coherent and workable line where effectively shades of grey, where there's no changes to the domestic character of the property, are on the right side of the line, but there is an acceptance that if there is an unusual degree of adaptation or specialist equipment or discrete space, then that might be something that would give rise to the need for rateability on as part of a composite hereditament. Now, to my mind, that's a very wise and practical approach, because what it does is it puts the coherence and workability of non-domestic raids at the centre of the reasoning, and it seeks to create something that is easily to adapt, easy to understand, easy to adapt, easy to apply, albeit accepting that the particular facts might in any given case require there to be a drawing of a line, but the basic approach is to allow for the line to be drawn where there is a degree of discoverability of the discreteness and something unusual. So it creates a flexible, pragmatic, general approach, albeit acknowledging that there will be some boundaries where the facts take one outside of the ordinary course of events. And it's crucial to understanding the approach applied to just reflect on what the president said at the end of his decision. And he said this, he said, "There must be very large numbers of homes in the country in which those living there do some or all of their work unvisited by employees or clients or business associates, in rooms that have not been structurally adapted and without any outward indication that someone is working at the property. It would, I think, be a consequence of the Valuation Officer's contention that many such homes would be potentially rateable. In order to discover who is working at home and to what extent and in what accommodation would require investigation on a very considerable scale. Unless such investigations were carried out, the incidence of rating in such circumstances would be haphazard and injustice would arise as a result. With the approach that I have described above, on the other hand, the problems involved in identifying rateable property would be much less. Where a business at the premises is advertised, or if planning permission is sought for building operations or a business use, the Valuation Officer may well be alerted and can take steps accordingly. Where there are no such indications, the probability is, it seems to me, that if work is being done there, it will be work of the sort that falls within the scope of the use of the property for the purpose of living accommodation." So in essence, this has to work. If one takes an expansive approach, trying to rate what's going on behind a closed door with no outward manifestation, then either it is going to be unworkable or it is going to be arbitrary in its application, neither of which is a satisfactory approach for the imposition of tax. Whereas an emphasis on external discoverability is a sensible, workable guide which will allow valuation officers to carry out their tasks in a more objective and coherent way, which will underpin the credibility of the approach to non-domestic rates. Now that, it seems to me, is an incredibly wise and sensible approach that is a key takeaway, not just in the situation of home working, but actually in the way that non-domestic rates should be administered so far as necessary. The distinctions should be objectively valid, they should be ascertainable, and they should lead to the imposition of tax on as consistent a base as possible. And it seems to me, therefore, that Tully not only puts the boundary in a correct and workable place for home working, but also offers some wisdom as to how the Valuation Officer might best approach his or her difficult task, looking for objective ascertainability and coherent and workable boundaries as far as possible, so that the credibility and fairness of non-domestic rates can be maintained to the extent that that is possible. So that concludes my observations in relation to the approach to home working based on the Tully case in 2003. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you do have any comments or feedback, please feel free to email me at dkolinsky, K-O-L-I-N-S-K-Y, at landmarkchambers.co.uk. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Goodbye.